you're in this definitive production here in Chicago of Iceman Cometh, but a 5-hour marathon, and it's not even your first, it's your third production of this play. Yeah. Is it fair to call you the Iron Man of the American theater?
Iron Pants? Old Iron Pants?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 289, Mr. Brian Dennehy. Olivier Award and 2-time Tony Award-winning actor Brian Dennehy just completed a hugely successful sold-out run of Eugene O'Neill's epic play, The Iceman Cometh, directed by Robert Falls at the Goodman Theater in Chicago. I was lucky enough to see this mammoth production, and even luckier to be able to talk to Brian about it. He started by telling me who he thinks the real Iron Man of the theater might be, and how this man impacted some great theatrical literature.
Probably the Iron Man of the American theater would be somebody like James O'Neill, Gene's father, who did, in those days, would do... Well, interestingly enough, they probably didn't do 8 shows a week, although they would when they... If he was in Chicago working, which he did in the 1880s, they would do. But on the road, he eventually wound up doing Count of Monte Cristo, I don't know, 4,000 times or 5,000 times. Essentially vaudeville productions and vaudeville theaters, where they would do 45-minute versions of it, and he might do 2 or 3 a day, but it might be only 2 or 3 days a week, and then they get on a train and go on to the next venue.
Yeah,
those guys were tough. I mean, that was that was tough, especially riding a train between, as of course Mary Tyrone or Ella O'Neill, who was O'Neill's mother. Constantly complained about it, and until finally the old man built her a house, although kind of constructed a house or slapped the house together, would be a better way of describing it, in New London, which became Monte Cristo Cottage, which became the scene of Long Day's Journey,
yeah,
and or Ah Wilderness,
yeah,
depending upon whether you like the dramatic version or the comic version.
You've done a lot of O'Neill. Are you drawn particularly to his plays or him as a playwright?
Well, when I was growing up 40, 50 years ago, let's see, would have been mid-50s, I guess. I was 16, 17 in high school. And Jose Quintero and Jason Robards did a famous revival of this play, Iceman Cometh, at the old Circle in the Square, which had maybe 100 seats. And not that I was unaware of O'Neill beforehand, I was always, as a kid, I was always a tremendous reader. I still am a big reader. But I was aware of O'Neill, but like most Americans in those days, vaguely aware of him. He was a kind of an artifact of the past. But then suddenly, Iceman Cometh was done hugely successfully in New York with a wonderful cast, which included Peter Falk and some fantastic actors. Al Lewis was in it.
The old Vaudevillian.
Yeah, well, Al Lewis went on to... No, I think you're thinking of somebody else. Al Lewis went on to become a fixture in Car 54, Where Are You?, which shows you what happens when you succeed in O'Neill. If you're lucky, you get a mindless TV series.
And the Munsters. He played Grandpa and the Munsters.
That's right. He played Grandpa and the Munsters. And terrific. Anyway, there were wonderful actors in that company, in addition to, of course, Jason Robards. And 6 months later, this is about 2 years or so after O'Neill died. I think he died in 53 in Boston. 2 years, and he died in relative obscurity. 2 years later, of course, Long Day's Journey opened up, or 3 years later, in New York. It had opened up first in Stockholm, interestingly enough. O'Neill had stipulated in his will that he never wanted the play produced, and it could only be read 25 years after his death. Didn't take long for Carlotta to ignore that. But to her credit,
yeah,
the play needed to be done, needed to be seen, needed to be heard. which it has ever since that point. But in any case, I was always aware, then became very much more with Jason and Quintero, much more aware of it. And so in the last 30 years, I've done quite a bit of O'Neill. Bob and I have done Iceman Cometh now 3 times. We did Touch of the Poet, which is not done at all, hardly. And I remember sitting with Jason one night years ago, and we both agreed that that was our favorite O'Neill play, probably because it is so difficult to do.
Yeah.
It's very difficult for the audience, but it's a wonderful play. And it's more stately mansion. I haven't done that, but I did Huey, and I did Desire Under the Elms, and Long Day's Journey. So I've done a lot of O'Neill. Yeah.
Well, we saw, Reduced Shakespeare Company. I anticipated coming to see Iceman Cometh, thinking there is no play that needs reducing more than this one. But yet, the enormity of it is part of it. It's part of the experience of it. Well, we leapt to our feet not only because you guys are great, but because we were all celebrating what we had achieved by sitting through it.
You leapt to your feet because you had to go to the bathroom. But the fact is that all of O'Neill's plays, and certainly this is the most, but there are other ones that are longer. I mean, Strange Interlude is 6 hours long, and they have a dinner break usually when they do it. And then you've got, something Millions. I can't think of it now. They're all lots of long plays.
Right.
Shaw, of course, wrote the longest of all, which is Don Juan in Hell, I think. Which I don't know how long that runs, but look. The thing about O'Neill's plays, it's not just the length of them, it's the repetitions. The repetitions of a theme, in many cases, the repetitions of phrases over and over again. And when you're rehearsing it, your reaction is, oh my God, did you ever have an editor? Did anybody ever say, Gene, you know? But the fact is, it was all brilliantly understood by him, mm-hmm. which was... this type of theater is like a tsunami. It's rising water. And unless you're completely dead mentally or emotionally, you are caught up in it and swept away in it. And after 4 hours, 4 hours and 15 minutes, in the middle of the fourth act, the audience, as drained and as exhausted as they may be, and certainly as the actors are, they are listening,
yeah.
absolutely listening, and they're being bombarded by this passion and this intelligence and this point of view, because there's a very strong point of view in everything, and they surrender to it. They can't really help but surrender to it. So there was no other writer, certainly not American writer, like him. In that sense, Mary McCarthy, who was a famous writer herself and wrote a book for which I guess she's going to be remembered, called The Group, which was not a great book, but she wrote a lot for The New Yorker. She wrote reviews and essays for The New Yorker and had an acerbic, nasty wit. Once wrote about O'Neill, and this is very true. She wrote that O'Neill is not a good writer, but he is a great one.
Mm.
And that's as good a description, capsule description. You know, he doesn't worry about the lesser effects or the lesser game of writing a witty sentence and having a witty exchange. He doesn't worry about that. He worries about the cumulative effect of this passionate interpretation of life and the important things of life, the necessity of pipe dreams, the necessity of illusion, of self-delusion, this modern dilemma, and which he understood right away in the 20s. He read Freud and Jung in the German, taught himself German so he could read Freud and Jung. Only a polymath like O'Neill could do that, a polymath who had flunked out of both Princeton and Harvard, which is the only thing an intellectual should really do. But in any case, a genuine intellectual, which he was. He understood all the stuff about modern psychology and understanding the human mind and so forth, and he rejected most of it,
yeah.
and said, that what differentiates us from the animals who do live according to instinct is that we dream. And the dream is the most important part of our lives. The dream is not something that has to be controlled or ignored or turned one's back upon. It has to be understood and nurtured, and the dreams are what make us different from everybody else, and they should not be taken out of our lives. They should be cherished. Mm-hmm. Cherished.
Well, that was the big takeaway for me from this production, much more so than just having read it, was for a almost five-hour play of a bunch of drunks sitting around, it was a surprisingly active play and optimistic one at the end.
Yeah, because, I mean, what O'Neill is saying is that life is a certain thing. It's all kinds of disparate energy flying off in all kinds of different directions, a lot of them negative. But it's all life.
Yeah.
It's all to be grabbed hold of and used and cherished and, if possible, understood. But understanding is not nearly as important as actually living it. And too many people tried to live it in a way that essentially controls it. Says, I will take over life. I will hold life and I'll mold it to my purpose and to my objectives and so on and so forth. Then O'Neill says, that's all nonsense. You're lucky to be there. I mean, you've won the lottery just being born. And you've got a certain amount of time. Time is the only thing you have, not a tremendous amount of time. And what you better do is find out what life is going to do to you. Yeah. And then enjoy it if you can. And if you can't, at least experience it. At least let it happen to you. Let it occur to you. Which doesn't mean you live completely a life without any discipline or any idea or any ambition at all. Because God knows O'Neill had all kinds of ambition. But whatever the experiences are, they're all part of existence, and you're a fool if you don't take advantage of every minute and just let it happen to you.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Brian, and I'm the stage doorkeeper here at the York Theatre Royal, and you are listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSE? This week we hit the road, the wrong side of the road, in the UK, performing The Complete World of Sports Abridged in Buxton, Exeter, Newbury, and Nottingham. And then in the next 3 weeks, performing in Truro, Poole, Tunbridge Wells, Peterborough, Canterbury, Norwich, Derby, Hereford, Rhyl, Barnsley, Salford, Lichfield, Basingstoke, Crawley, Bedford, and Tewkesbury, before finally settling down for 6 weeks at the Arts Theatre in London. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for The Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Brian Dennehy. Brian played Larry Slade in this recent production of Iceman Cometh at the Goodman, but had played the arguably more central role of Hickey twice before. In this production, Hickey was played by Nathan Lane, and that's where our conversation turned next.
You played Hickey twice. Now you're playing Larry Slade in this production. At any point in rehearsal, did you look at Nathan Lane as playing Hickey and just kind of give him a kind of a, really, you're going to do it that way kind of a thing?
No. No, Nathan is a far better actor than I am, and he's a star for a reason. His skills are incredible. And his understanding and his determination, his desire to do the profound work, the difficult work, the hard work, is enormous, which is why, you know, he moved from essentially, I mean, he's done serious parts before, but this is the most serious part. This is certainly the most serious and difficult and demanding of American parts, because it's essentially American. It's O'Neill's understanding of what all of the traps are, what all of the weaknesses are of the American environment, the American experience, the American version of life. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the people on stage are victims of ambitions and drives and needs that they could not particularly fulfill. I mean, Larry has a wonderful line early in the play describing these abject, down-and-out, drunken bums. He says, "I've never known more contented men. It isn't often men attain the true goal of their heart's desire." Now, it's a sardonic line, but the sardonic quality doesn't mean it's not true.
Right.
These people are contented. They have achieved their heart's desire, which is to just accept their victimhood and the fact that they're probably the architects of their own disaster. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right, right.
So,
is Slade easier apart, or is it in some ways harder? Because you're on stage the entire show.
Well, you got to have. I have a typical Irish ass, which is I have no ass at all, all belly and no ass. So it's sitting in one position, and you have to, for long periods of time, you have to try not to move, because you don't want even accidentally focused to slip from one side to the other, which is physically difficult. And of course, my arthritis barks at me constantly. But in terms of the problem. The normal problems of acting. Certainly Hickey is one of the most difficult roles, and I would not put Larry into that. Every part has its own problems that have to be solved. Larry's problem is, of course, as is everyone, including Hickey, is that Larry has his own pipe dreams.
Yeah.
And his are rudely ripped away from him, and he only really understands that in the last moments of the play. Hickey never gets it, ironically, even the man who's trying to destroy everybody's illusions never completely loses his. But, it's easy to make the case that he has really become demented.
Is one of the things that you like about the theater, I mean, aside from the money, obviously.
That's really funny.
The ability to just play different roles, not be typecast. I mean, that's one of the pleasures of seeing this, is to see Nathan in this role, a role that he doesn't necessarily get to play.
Yeah, it drives him crazy when people say that, but I guess it's true. I don't know. The only thing that's interesting to me about the theater anymore, I mean, there was a time when I had ambitions and I felt that I had to do this, and this was a move up, and this was a move sideways, and this potentially was a move down. And, I went through all that. I'm an American like everybody else. The only thing that interests me now is going into a rehearsal room with a really good script and a bunch of other actors and trying to figure it all out and trying to come up with something that when you go out on stage and there's an audience there, you give them something. You produce something for them so that they understand something about themselves that they may not have understood beforehand. And that's really the ball game. The ball game is it's here for you if you want to reach out and take it. This piece of understanding, which was not created by me, which was created by a man writing in the mountains outside of San Francisco in 1939 or 1940, but it's still significant and meaningful, and it has meaning to you if you want to consider it. And so what's interesting to me is not so much even the performances, which can be destroyed by one person opening a candy or somebody coughing inappropriately. What's important to me is the rehearsal process of trying to discover it for myself and then trying to understand what it is you have to do as an actor to make it available to the audience. You can't do any more than that. You can't do it anymore. You can't grab them by the neck and shake them. You make it available to them. And as I always say to people who bitch about audiences, hey, they're the ones who came.
Yeah.
They're here. You know, the ones who didn't come, they've already told us what they think about it. But these people are actually here. They bought the tickets. They want to hear something.
Yeah.
Well, you make it available to them. But the most interesting part of the whole process is not the performance for me. It's the rehearsal. Yeah. It's discovering it for myself and for the rest of us.
Cool. Well, I won't bother you over much, but I will ask one final question. You've worked with You've worked with one of our Reduced Shakespeare Company members, Aaron Crone. Do you have anything kind or disparaging to say about him?
Well, he's going to be a big star. He is an extraordinary actor. He's got a great intelligence, got a great voice. I did this play with him where he had a great part, which he grabbed every possible syllable from, every little place that you could squeeze juice out of, he squeezed it out. He's a big talent, very big talent, and it's beginning to be recognized. He's going to play Henry V up in Stratford this year, which will be fascinating to watch. And unless I miss my guess, I mean, he's going to be... It's hard to predict what happens in this business, because if you got some 25-year-old kid who's 6'2" and gorgeous and has a six-pack, and he can... walk into a room and speak a line without making a fool out of himself. Yeah, that's the formula for stardom these days, whether it's television or, like I say to people, I said, I don't see it in the movies anymore. I said, yeah, I know. I said, there don't seem to be any 73-year-old vampires. the only 73-year-old magicians are British ones. In any case... That's a whole different part of the business.
Yeah.
This guy is the rarest of thing for a relatively young man. I guess he's 40. He wants to be a great actor. And he's got enormous talent. And he will be a great actor. He has it right there in front of him.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your strange interludes via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on many of our website pages, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to Webmaster Matt Rippey, Iron Daddy of the American Theater Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Sam Lowe. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to Brian Dennehy for making his long day even longer by talking to me, and to Brian Sullivan, the stage door guard at the York Theater Royal, where we just concluded a fantastic week. And thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 289/867 of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. And I'll leave you with this last little slightly gossipy tidbit. Just before Iceman Cometh opened in Chicago, Brian Dennehy gave an interview to Time Out magazine where he called Jessica Lange a bitch for taking a very long time to decide to not do the 2003 production of Long Day's Journey into Night, and then announcing her decision publicly and apparently insultingly. As we were getting ready to record our conversation, Brian was explaining this story to me and offered this conclusion.
But what happened was, of course, we got Vanessa Redgrave.
Yeah.
Which turned out pretty well.
Yeah.
Vanessa won a Tony, and I won a Tony, and we won Tonys, and the show was a huge hit, so...
Happy ending.
So now, Jessica, thanks very much.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.